I have
current geek.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to Current Geek. It's Autopilot edition of Current Geek, a chance for us to watch a pilot episode of a TV show and geek out about it. I'm Scott Johnson. He's Tom Merritt. And this week we are talking about Memories of Alhambra.
You up say, oh, Scott.
Buracha,
which I would say if you were calling me on a phone.
Go
I
guess to.
I
should, like, yeah, thing. You have to do the whole thing. I don't.
They say it about 15 times in this episode of Memories of Alhambra. I think this is when my wife was watching this. I think this is when she learned that, and then she taught me that, and then we taught our niece that.
Oh, very nice. Well done. A little uncle aunt education moment. I like it. It is a show that is on Netflix. It is labeled as a Netflix original, although I think this is just one of those where they, you know,
it's
pay for
a co-production, I think. Premiered on TVN in Korea, but is on Netflix internationally. It's pretty new. Came out December 1st, 2018, and ran through January 20th. If you're like, wow, that's real short, that's kind of the way they do it in Korea sometimes. They'll run two, sometimes more episodes per week for a short period of time and just get them out there.
And the closest we've gotten to this on Autopilot is the Chinese production of, what was it called?
Ashes of Love.
Ashes of Love, which is totally different and not connected to this at all, but it is.
Yeah, Ashes of Love is Wuxia, or even more specifically, Xianxia, which is kind of a fantasy world. This is very much the real world, fictional story, though, with some fictional technology.
That's right. And we are presented with English subtitles. This is not dubbed for my dumb ears, which is good because it's important.
And what's interesting is while the majority of the dialogue is Korean because the characters are Korean, it takes place in Spain. So you get a little Spanish in there too, and a few English speaking folks that are not subtitled. Yeah. Because
early on in the train, you get an English guy. Later on, Spanish waiter.
Well, also the guy who speaks English to him on the train later speaks Spanish. So I didn't quite.
Right. Right.
I'm like, oh, was he just speaking English because he's like, oh, that guy's Korean. He'll probably understand English, not Spanish.
Well, he had a perfect English accent for an American accent. Uh-huh. So when he was talking anyway, so that left me a little bit confused. But the waiter later on, he speaks a little English, keeps wondering why he keeps coming in to use the bathroom or whatever.
That made sense to me because it's a touristy area in Granada.
Right.
And so he would probably speak English to anybody he didn't know spoke Spanish, I would think.
So this is a really fascinating thing, and I like once in a while that we do this. It's easy. It's honestly, it's easy for Tom and I to go, hey, we should see the first Jeffersons episode or whatever. Like we can autopilot in our wheelhouse all day, or in things that were part of the popular zeitgeist in America growing up or something.
And we will.
We certainly do and will. But here's an example of something that's new-ish. It's available to us via streaming medium only. Is the only way you and I can even get it. And it also represents kind of a new acceptance of genre shifting, like new kinds of genres coming to American audiences, at least from my perspective, that is super interesting to me. This is a show that my brother, who is Korean, and his wife, also Korean, love. They love these shows. They love all the Korean content on Netflix. And it's not that shocking because they are very steeped in the culture. They both speak very fluent Korean. So they're hearing all this in the raw English or the raw Korean language way that you would expect them to. And I'd heard him make mention of the show before, didn't pay it any attention. He didn't really explain it, so I didn't know understand kind of the core concept of what's going on here. And yet here I am all this time later. I check it out. Tom says, you're going to like it. I say, well, let's see. And I have to say, I liked it. In fact, I liked it a lot. And my only complaint is, they take a long time in one episode to just get the basics of the story down so that I know where this dude is, what the world's sort of trying to tell me. And now I feel like I got to keep going. So congratulations. Well done.
Yeah, I noticed that too. The run to the train from our early character, who is apparently the inventor of this virtual world game, this augmented reality game. Man, it's like, okay, I get it. He's running from a guy. Get him on the train, for goodness sake. Like, it seems to take forever.
Yeah.
When our main character, Yujin Woo, shows up in Granada to follow up on the disappearance of the AR's creator, It seems to take him forever to get settled in the hostel. It's like, man, he's spending a lot of time with this lady from the hostel and going, yeah, okay, we get it. He's up on the sixth floor and there's no electricity because it's a, you know, kind of a ramshackle hostel kind of place. And so I asked Eileen about that because she has watched this entire run, which I think is another good point that this is a complete series, even though it's so new. And she said, oh, yeah, the kid who is the inventor is from the Korean boy band EXO.
Oh,
so this is like Justin Bieber, right? Is you're going to milk that. You want to show him as much as possible. And same thing with Jung Hee Ju is the woman who's running the hostel. Shin Hee Park, who plays her, is super famous, has been in a ton of K-dramas. And so you want to spend more time kind of, you know, getting her on because all the people are freaking out who watch these all the time, like, oh my gosh, there she is. And she's interacting with this guy Hyunbin. And, you know, so some of that long setup is lost on us because we don't know the context of the wider Korean drama universe. But I felt like once he actually puts on the contacts and starts playing the augmented reality game, it took off.
It
didn't feel long anymore.
No. And in fact, it's hard to tell if that's even where we're going. Like I kind of knew where we were going. Cause you had told me, you'd said, hey, it's about this game. It's about this AR experience. It's about this thing. And there's all this intrigue and all this stuff around it. A little bit of, oh, what's the Spielberg just made the movie? Why can't I think of it all of a sudden? The VR movie.
Oh, Ready Player One.
Ready Player One. There's a little bit of that in there. Like, there's just this feeling of like there's a cool virtual space that nobody knows about, and it's gonna get big and cool. I guess that's not really Ready Player One. Everyone knew about it. But the point is like that it's playing in that market. But I didn't know just how hard they'd go into the gamification of that world. Like, it's literally like, oh, wow, the guy that jumps off the statue and fights me every time is incredibly well realized, and he has got stats, and your sword has 50 damage points to it. It can inflict 50 damage. It can crit. It has 50 basically health points or repair. You know, you have to repair it after you wear the thing down. And it's just it's a video game. Like, in a lot of ways, you were right comparing it to an MMO. They use a lot of MMO and RPG tropes, and they were 100% understandable to me, like, and felt legit. Like, that's the kind of stuff you would do.
This was written by gamers, right? These people play the games, because both the scenes of the guys back in Korea who are sort of watching the 2D version of what's happening in the game, because it's, you know, it's happening over a networked situation, so they can kind of see what's going on from his perspective, are exactly like your friends watching you while you play, like trying to give you backseat advice and cringing when you do things wrong. And then our main player, who's in the real world, right? He's in Granada and has to run into this restaurant's bathroom to get his new sword every time he dies, because he loses the sword, it gets broken. It was such a great representation of that frustration of playing a new game and trying to beat that first boss. I already had that feeling of, you know what, he's going to run into this guy later once he's leveled up and just kick the crap out of him, because that's what you do.
Right.
Later on, you find that hard boss and you just go, man, I'm so much more powerful. It's just going to be so fun to squash you now. Like, I was getting all those feelings, but then layered on top of like, man, it's bad enough to have to like run from your body when you die in a game. Imagine having to run in real life to the restroom of a bar to get your sword every time you die. I thought that was really clever.
Yeah, I did too. It worked for me. I have a big question though about the scope of the thing, and I'm going to have to keep watching it to do it. But I assume the intrigue comes from this stuff is so real and so palpable. Like, even he describes the sword as a thing he can grip in this otherwise just augmented reality AR, like you'd use with your phone, except the fidelity is so strong that,
right. And the key is that our main guy who's staying in the hostel, who's playing the game in Granada, is the CEO of a company who makes contact lenses that have augmented reality. So it's set in our near future, where instead of working on augmented reality glasses, they've already gone to augmented reality contacts, which of course makes it easy to shoot because you don't have to show him wearing a thing. Mm-hmm. He's getting all of the interface of the game through the contact lenses. But he has never made a game. And in fact, at one point he mentions like, man, the lenses are having a hard time keeping up with the game. This game came from a kid who's disappeared and only two CEOs know it exists. And so our CEO friend wants to get it first, wants to make sure he keeps it out of the hand of his competitor. So at first you feel like, oh, okay, our guy's the good guy and the other guy's a bad guy because the kid who invented it was, you know, wanting to give it to our guy. He thought the other guy was worse, but it turns out our guy is not completely sympathetic either, because the kid who created it was a minor, and and all these Korean dramas end with a twist. Like every episode ends with a twist. Yeah. The twist here was that the woman who ran the horrible hostel, who he just chewed out, he finds out on the phone is the legal guardian of the kid, and so if he wants to get approval to take the game, he has to get it from her.
Right. So now we gotta. Yeah, well, and we knew when we saw her, even though I didn't know that she was a hugely popular Korean actress, when I saw her, I knew immediately. I was like, well, all right, we're not done with her, obviously. Like, this isn't just a bit part where she introduces the hostel and then we're done. She's in this full, you know, full on forever.
Yeah, yeah.
And so it's good to see at the end how that works. I didn't realize that was a thing, though, that they always make sure to have a big fat twist at the end. But it felt fine. I mean, this doesn't feel... Let me put it this way. I watch a lot of anime here and there. Someone will make a recommendation, say you should check out this anime or whatever. It's all Japanese stuff, obviously, but I'll watch that. And then I'll see, like some of these Chinese dramas are on Netflix and other stuff. And I find a lot of cultural breaks, like a lot of stuff where I'm like, that's a weird thing to spend time doing. Like, why would you even do that? It's just a culture thing. I know it's me, and it's me just going, I'm resistant to... Why is that in here? Why is the pacing so strange? Especially in anime, it just throws me. This didn't have that, other than the slow buildup. But it didn't have like weird, broken, out of place scenes.
Right, because that slow buildup only feels slow if you don't know, but it doesn't feel weird. It just feels like, this feels kind of slow.
Right.
It's not breaking the world.
Right? Yeah, this could have been, I don't know how to put this. It's kind of like, you know, people always say, do you play a lot of RPGs? I say, oh yeah, I love them. What kinds? And they want to know if I play Japanese RPGs. And I do occasionally, but I would prefer to play Western story-based RPGs. Things like Skyrim, things like Warcraft, things that are, you know, that ilk. More the sort of the European King Arthur and down sort of idea. Merlin the Wizard, Tolkien level stuff. That's where I'm at. And so when it comes to JRPGs, I appreciate them, but I think they're often odd and discordant. And I feel that way about a lot of the TV stuff that we get out of Asia. This didn't have that. This felt like it was a little lighter than I expected, a little more humor than I expected, but it also kind of had like a Mr. Robot kind of vibe to it. Like, I don't know who to trust. I don't know who's in charge of what. Do I even trust this guy? He seems like he's likable and affable, but he's also there for a reason, and that is to dominate this tech and to take it for his own.
And he's horrible to the hostel owner right before he finds out he needs her.
Yep.
And then just starts to smile. It's like, okay, this guy's kind of creepy.
He's a little weird that way. I mean, the only scene that maybe felt like it was just kind of off, it was maybe the sister having to dance in the kitchen while he's trying to eat his ramen. It's just an odd 10 minutes, you know, of like, why are you doing this?
I think that was trying to just establish that, okay, this is not a luxury hotel, which, you know, we've established 16 or 17 other ways already, but, with a little comedy of like, oh yeah, the teenage girl obviously would be, you know, preparing for her dance number. And because there's nowhere else in the hostel to practice, he's going to have to deal with that. Look at this guy. Look at this fish out of water, you know, having to deal with these young, you know, these teenage girl things around him. Yeah.
Teenage girl things.
I mean, I got it, but I also agree that it was like, you didn't need it. It was probably really funny to somebody who has a daughter just like that, or is a daughter just like that. I was like, oh my gosh, that's totally me. I could see that happen.
So how does, obviously it's on Netflix, so people can watch it, and it's I assume it gets, you know, plenty of views or whatever, but this is probably huge in Korea. Like, am I safe in assuming this is a gigantic hit over
there? It's been pretty popular on Netflix, and it was one of the highest rated dramas in cable television history in Korea. A 14th episode of this series recorded a 10.025% nationwide audience share.
Is that high? It must be high.
One out of every 10 people was watching the show.
That's pretty high then. Yeah.
That's pretty high. We don't get that kind of share on TV shows in the United States anymore.
Not anymore, pretty right? Rare. We used to, I think we kind of used to. We don't really do that anymore.
Yeah, yeah. Like Cheers and stuff used to be in the 15 to 20% back in the heyday, right?
Yeah. I think when you had like three channels and cable was just starting or whatever, and so we had more reason to zero in.
I think we may have done people a disservice focusing on the differences and focusing on the weirdness of the beginning, because I feel like the main story is going to be about the game. What? How did you feel about the gameplay?
Okay, so I hope that's right. I hope that is what it's mostly about. And that they did, I mean, I'm going to keep going because I want to know, because it did it intrigued me enough to want to keep going with the series. They really need to make sure they skirt that line really well. Like, it needs to be the game needs to be a part of stuff, and it can't always just be him out swinging his arms in public and people wondering what's wrong with him.
Yeah, that joke will get old. We'll have to come up with. And I have not watched this, but Eileen has. And from the little I gleaned from her, there's other aspects of the game that will become problematic.
Oh,
in the future. Okay. And then there's this espionage race, the corporate espionage race to figure out who can steal the game. I think there's some infections in the game that starts to cause problems. Some, you know, computer virus type stuff. The majority of the plot is centered around the gameplay and the intrigue around the gameplay.
How much of it is, I don't know if Eileen has said, but how much of it is centered around them and their relationship, hostile girl and computer?
That is one of the quibbles that I've heard. There is no love story until later in this series. And a lot of people wish there had never been a love story. I actually don't know. I assume the love story is between them. But early on, they don't go the obvious route that you would go, right? Mm-hmm. And so that is interesting to me. Everybody who loves the show does say they wished it had ended differently. And so that's kind of hanging over.
And they're done now? So
yeah,
whatever
that's it.
All right. Yep. No
it
more
ran
content.
From December 2018 through January 20th.
All right. So they had a plan and they executed their plan. They told their story and they got out.
Yep.
Something about that makes me want to keep going too, because I like it when a show knows what it wants to do and when it wants to finish. And
yeah,
it sounds like one of those. So I'll probably keep going. But I really,
the director, of this, Ahn Gil-ho, directed a series called Stranger, and the writer of this series, Jae Jeon Sung, also wrote another Korean series that I love called W, which is about a woman who gets sucked into her father's comic book world.
Whoa.
So he's good at writing these sort of rich universes with fantasy implications. And that makes me excited to see what he does with an augmented reality world. But I actually super enjoyed the opening series where he's in Granada, he's in that little roundabout area with the statue, and the statue jumps down.
Yeah.
And the statue can hit the car, and it's not really damaging the car, but he is convinced through the augmented reality that the car got damaged. It's that realistic. I thought that all carried off really well, especially the way they show you what's happening in sort of a game world view, and then pull into his interface where you can see things like, you know, hit points and how much health you have left and all of that. I think it was a nice way to show you that you're seeing what's happening in the game, but without bothering you with the interface of the game all the time, but still giving you a chance to see what that interface looked like.
Yeah. And what's fun about that is, I have the notion, and this could be, I mean, basically just call this a permanent, forecast for me, but I think that the real future is augmented reality or mixed reality in some way. But the idea that the world around us is sort of skinned so that we can play in that space is way more compelling than just virtual space, because virtual space is rarely mapped onto real world objects. So the idea of running down a street that is mapped to enhance whatever experience I'm having is way more compelling to me than just a completely created one inside of a helmet. And so this show seems to me like they're leaning into that idea that the fidelity could get to the point that we are, you know, mathematically perfectly putting objects where they need to be, creating damage models where they should be, that the eye is perceiving all of those things. If you pop that contact out, he wouldn't see any of it. That's so intriguing to me because I think that's the path. I don't know how soon we get to that level of fidelity, but I don't think it's that crazy to think that we might get there.
The one thing about this is that the design of the game is unrealistic in execution right now, just because it's so very complicated, but realistic in possibility. In other words, you could see that we have the technology to do it, even though it's complex.
What do you think the horse, the guy on the horse, was about? Was that supposed to symbolize? Was it just?
I don't know if you noticed, but he showed up in the preview for the next episode too.
Oh no, I missed that. I didn't watch the credits rolled, and I didn't watch it. Crap. So he comes back. All right, that's interesting.
So I think he's a symbol of something, and then you have to beat the guy on the statue first before you can figure that out.
I mean, we've already shown we're willing to all stop at street corners and capture Pokemon. Why wouldn't we be willing to stop at a corner and fight a statue that jumped down?
Well, that's the part I'm curious if they get into also is that, I mean, this isn't a mass game, so you're not going to have the Pokemon issues, but at some point he's going to run into problems where the game design tells him to do something and people in real life are going to be saying, no, don't do that.
Hmm. And again, I don't want to spoil anything, and I don't know if Eileen said this or not, but does the rest of the show, is this just a big puzzle? Like, did the designer set up a bunch of Ready Player One style tests and puzzles for him to solve in order to get the thing? Like, is that what I'm buying into here? And if it is, I think I'm okay with that. Or is it just random encounters and I'm just fighting stuff and I also budding relationships happening, but also, hey, we want this technology because we want to sell it? Or like, I guess I'm wondering what main path they go down.
I don't know where it's going. I get the feeling it's not Ready Player One and that there's not a grand design that everyone has to compete for. But I do think there's a portion of this that will be the kid who designed it left clues in the game, either about his disappearance or regarding how to, you know, unlock the game and make it yours or something like that.
Be cool if this seems dumb to say because it exists now and I can watch it for what it is. But you know how, you know, The Office was popular here, so they make it was popular in the UK, then it came to the US, and then like every country got a version of The Office. Everyone has a version of Survivor. Everyone has a version of whatever. I would like it if we got to a point where we start seeing more, like this Korean drama, more Asian dramas, more of these concepts get made for audiences here. Does that make sense? Like, in the same reason that you would make these other things for other countries, other cultures, other languages, I feel like I would get more out of this if I wasn't reading subtitles. Maybe this is a whole different issue about subtitles than me, because I feel like when I'm reading a thing, I'm not watching a thing, and it kind of drives me crazy. And I also don't want dubbing because dubbing sounds terrible, or can. So
I don't know. I kind of like Godzilla style dubbing.
I mean, it depends, right? Like if you're watching some crappy old kung fu movie, yes, you want really bad dubbing. That makes the experience even better. I agree with that. But something like this, where I want to take it seriously, I don't know. It seems like a really cool concept, and I don't know of any equivalent, you know, version of some American thing that's like this. Like, it wouldn't surprise me if some other country, France or somebody, says, hey, we're going to make a version of Mr. Robot, and we're going to have it here in French language. Like, why not? So why not something
like
this?
Yeah, I mean, that's the sad thing sometimes, is that this is a really great execution of a story about an augmented reality game in Spain. Somebody's going to decide it has to be remade with English-speaking actors to make it accessible. And part of me is going to say, well, it won't be the same. It won't be as good in many ways. Maybe it'll be better. Maybe it won't, right? So I'm not against it being done, but I wish it didn't have to be. I don't know if that's just people getting used to subtitles. The more subtitled shows you watch, the easier it is, or whether it's making dubbing really a lot better. Because Netflix is doing a lot with dubbing to figure out how to make it smooth so it doesn't disrupt your viewing, like you're saying. So because man, I it's funny, I'm watching people in chat like, oh, they're talking about a Korean drama, that's out of my wheelhouse. Oh, they're talking about some K drama, oh, I don't know. And I feel like this is what I'm trying to do by occasionally exposing us to this, is this isn't a some Korean drama. This is a really good story about augmented reality in Spain that happens to have been produced by a Korean team with Korean actors. But you shouldn't, like, you should take that part out of your brain if that's making you object to it. Like, well, I probably wouldn't understand it, because no, you're not going to understand the language. But if you make the effort to read the subtitles, I think you get a really good story out of it.
Right. Yeah, I think that's true. I don't know why. It's weird. It's like I there's a part of me, maybe it's just because I'm getting old. And back in the day, it felt like it was cool when you'd find out something was being made into an Americanized thing. And sometimes that goes really badly. Like something like Ghost in the Shell is not a great live action film based on a beloved manga and a beloved anime. And that's a bummer.
Imagine if Doctor Who got remade as an American show.
Oh, see, that sounds so bad.
Right.
Yeah, see,
depends on the show. Like, yeah. I'll argue, and I know people will argue back with me, but I'll argue that the U.S. office, having just finished watching the U.K. office, I'll argue the U.S. office ended up being better.
In the long run, yeah.
I think in its early days, it may not have been, but because it lasted longer, I think they found a stronger story to tell.
Yeah.
So it's, to me, it's not wrong to remake, but it's not guaranteed to be better. And like Essential Tremor says in the chat room, it's going to lose the cultural ticks if it's not a Korean drama. And I guess the question is the story hardy enough to stand up to that or not? I think the story probably is, because I'm arguing that the story, the fact that the story is made by a Korean production company with actors from Korea is irrelevant to your enjoyment of it. So if I believe that, then I should believe that you could have French actors or Russian actors or Kenyan actors do it, and it would be just fine as long as you had good actors and a good production team.
Yeah, you're probably right. I was watching Please Feed Phil or whatever it's called on Netflix, which is like a cooking show. This Phil dude, forgot his last name, goes all over the world, weird foods, that sort of stuff. He's famous for being co-creator, writer, and producer of Everybody Loves Raymond. And one time he went to Turkey and sat down at lunch with the Turkish version of Raymond and some of the actors who played in the Turkish version of Everybody Loves Raymond, which I guess is a thing. Yeah. And so it seems to happen in lots of ways, lots of directions. But I think you're right here. Like, this is, and that's what I enjoyed about this, is I didn't come out of this going, too many weird cultural hiccups that took me out of the story, or that would other, you know, if I was Korean, I sure would have got that scene better. It was none of that. It all made sense. It was all laid out. It was all well translated. Like, I didn't feel like any of the dialogue was goofy. It felt good. And that's enough. So maybe that's all it is if it just feels good enough and you can cross that line well enough, then who cares? And we're a more global society than ever. And this sort of stuff included, you know, people flock to see MCU movies in Chinese movie theaters, and we flock to see Hong Kong action movies in theaters. And like, everybody's kind of doing more of that than they ever have. So maybe it's a moot point and it doesn't matter, but I just think it's an interesting side note. Speaking of side notes, as you know, I grew up in a interesting semi-multicultural family. I had an older brother and two younger sisters, all adopted from Korea. The two sisters were here as infants, so they are as American as you or I in terms of culture and everything. They didn't know the language even. They just grew up, you know, English and an American, as Americans. My brother Matt, on the other hand, came when he was 10 and never lost his accent, always was pretty fluent in the language, even more so now because he spent a bunch of time back in Korea. He married a native Korean girl at the time who is now a naturalized citizen through marriage, but she's as Korean as you get and very fluent in the language. And watching this was like hanging out at their house, because when they're not talking to me or some of the, as my dad would say, whiteys in the house, they'll talk amongst themselves in Korean. And I would pick up words here and there and learn them and stuff from that. But it was always kind of chatter in the background for years and years, for decades. If I went over there right now, you would hear them say, oh, you guys want this and this and this. And then they would shift to talking in Korean. And watching this was like that. I could close my eyes and I could hear this Korean language happening, it was like being at my brother's house. It was a very odd, I don't know, it was a very odd feeling because I grew up with it and that language is just, it's like watching MASH. I can't watch MASH without thinking about this because they're all talking again in this language that I hear in our houses here all the time at family get-togethers. So I guess, you know, a Korean drama brings that one aspect in this for me that I wouldn't have.
Yeah, there was almost like a comfort feeling for you, wasn't there?
Yeah, it's like comfort food. It's like a weird, yeah. I don't know. I didn't expect it. And I know precious few words in Korean. Most of them are either dirty words or dumb words or, you know, it's all stupid stuff when I was a kid and my brother would teach me. But hearing, I've been watching Kim's Convenience as well, which is a Canadian production comedy thing about a Korean family that owns a convenience store up in Toronto. It's an awesome show. It's a lot of heart. I love it. But same thing, the accents and then spoken Korean dialogue just put me in this place and it feels like I'm home and it's weird. It's very, very odd feeling.
Yeah. When I chose this, I chose it because it was an international show that my wife highly recommended, had a tech angle with the augmented reality and was on Netflix, right? So you didn't have to get some special app to watch it.
Right.
And I didn't even think about the Korean connection for you there. That's really cool.
Yeah, I had neither until I started playing. In fact, it was when he was on the phone freaking out, the K-pop kid. I just was like, oh, it's like my brother getting mad at his dog. It's like, I could just hear it in the back of my head. It's very, very weird. But it was a cool thing to grow up in and to have that, to have that experience. But then to hear the Korean language now, even though I'm not anywhere near what I would say is a speaker of the language, I still, there's a feeling to it. There's a cadence to it, a rhythm that
Did
is unmistakable.
Did you catch yourself understanding things without, you know, where you'd read the subtitle and go, oh, yeah, right.
Oh, of course, yeah. Like Yeboseo and words like that. Obviously, yeah. The easy ones like hello are easy, but even those would, like, it was weird. Like, subliminally, I'm just picking up the word and I know what they mean. Yeah. And I barely had to glance at the words that they said. It was only when they'd get into more sort of complex conversations.
I'd almost feel
floors.
Like that would make it harder because you get lulled into the sense of understanding what they're saying and not relying on the subtitle and then try and be like, oh wait, no, that's out of my league.
No,
I gotta read that one.
It kind of did, because when he's arguing about what room to take at the hostel, I was kind of shake my head and blink my eyes and go, okay, wait a minute, I gotta read this, like. So it was weird that way, like it with the Chinese drama that we watched, I had to pay attention to the subtitles. Yeah, I know no Mandarin at all, and so for me, that was a must. In this case, I could kind of drift out of it a little and just be visual, because I didn't need to know. Like when he would say, one of them would swear because something crazy happened, and he'd have to go back and get the sword or something. I didn't have to see the words to know, because I've heard that before. Yeah. I've heard my brother get frustrated and I hear those same lines, and it was kind of awesome. So on that level, I also feel like I want to continue because I feel like, I don't know, there's like a weird... Got like a weird, like, clippy assistant with this in my head.
Yeah, I kind of want to hear a follow-up. If you keep watching this a significant number of episodes or even all the way through, and then you talk to Matt at some point.
Yeah.
I assume, like you said, it sounds like maybe there's a good chance he watched it. Yeah. Like, if you compare notes on that, I'd want to hear, I would want to be a fly on the wall in that conversation, but I definitely want to hear about it.
Yeah, and then the name of the thing, I think I told him I was going to be watching this with you, is how the conversation came up. And he said, oh, I love that show. Love that show. And so I think he has watched it. So yeah, getting that perspective would be cool. Maybe I'll just go to his house and watch some episodes just to see what
his
take is.
Too, yeah. Yeah.
Cause he understands all of it. It'll probably annoy him to have words on the screen cause he doesn't need them, but I don't know, but they'll go. I mean, they think this is they're having the time of their lives right now. Cause Netflix and other content
Vicky
streamers
and all that.
They just keep pumping the stuff into these streaming services and they're just like having a heyday. They used to have to order crazy DVD compilations from overseas. It was super expensive and weird and maybe not that legal, you know, to get any of this raw Korean television content. That was the way, because there just weren't channels here, and now they've got this like resurgence, and you know, we're all living in a weird time as it is. There's so much content, it's ridiculous, but they're loving it.
Yeah, that's one of the things that I think is interesting, because Netflix is a co-producer here. I think they did put more thought into making it globally appealing, mm-hmm. While walking the line of making sure they still satisfied their domestic audience, trying to maybe, you know, sand off a few of the rough edges for the non-Koreans out there. And that is a new kind of genre in a way. Mm-hmm. Terrace House, the Japanese reality show, is sort of the same way. They're constantly acknowledging like, oh, we have a worldwide audience and this must seem weird to them. And I think that's one of the unintended side effects of Netflix and Prime Video as well. And a lot of these streaming services is because they can be global so much cheaper than it ever was before. You don't have to put up satellites, you know, you don't have to ship tape. It allows them to do some things that just weren't possible before and make a, you know, a sort of a globally appealing culture that isn't just cultural imperialism.
Right. Right. Which kind of what, I mean, I don't mean this in a negative way because obviously we make a lot of cool stuff here in the States, but,
oh, sure.
But it's our chief export, certainly culturally, is our entertainment and we send it everywhere. So you're going to watch dubbed versions of The Simpsons everywhere.
Yeah.
And that's okay. That's great. Well done, everybody. But it's kind of nice to have it come back or see it coming from other directions that it traditionally has not come from, and not just our direction and out, and having us inform all of that entertainment. We still have plenty of it out there. I mean, there's no stopping us. It's nice, I think, to see more of what other cultures have to offer. And I don't know. Like, I remember seeing, like, John Woo movies when he was in Hong Kong, his early movies like Hard Boiled and stuff like that in the early 90s. And some of that stuff was made late 80s, very early 90s. And I'd see it 5-6 years late. But we get like a VHS tape and watch Hard Boiled and just go, what are we missing over here?
Right.
This is insane.
Yeah, I think that kind of thing was the first sort of break in the stereotype of subtitles, right? Mm-hmm. Up until John Woo, subtitles on a movie meant two things. It was either French or Italian and pretentious,
yep.
Or it was Japanese or Chinese and maybe kind of goofy.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And John Woo showed like, oh, no. That's not what it has to be about, yeah. Either way.
All
like,
that
we
action
can have
stuff.
Like a full-on unpretentious action movie that's really good.
Yeah.
And I think Netflix is sort of, you know, down the road in that chain of events, showing through Memories of the Alhambra, particularly, like, we can have a really cool series that's about you being put inside World of Warcraft or something like that, in the real world. And what does that mean? And how does that happen? And what is the intrigue? And who gets to control it? And what implications is that going to have on society? And it's going to have subtitles. Who cares?
Yeah.
That doesn't, you know, that is irrelevant to the kind of story they're telling.
Yeah. Y'all can read. Do a little bit of reading. It's good for me, too. I don't normally like subtitles, but it's good for me once in a while. Chat room, what's the game? There's a game that came out a few years ago. I don't think it's running anymore. It was from Funcom, and it was like, it was basically this. The real world's going on around you, but just beneath the surface. And it was supernatural in the game's case.
Yeah, I'm going to assume most people in the audience haven't watched this. And you should. Even if you just fast forward to the first 20 minutes and get to the good part. Or 40 minutes, whatever.
Yeah.
Get to the part where suddenly an ancient Spanish warrior with arrows in his back comes riding in on a horse,
yeah,
in the middle of a modern Granada city block. And only our hero can see him, mm-hmm, and then go from there. And he has to find a sword and do a battle, and he gets prompts. There's kind of, it's not an NPC character, so there's no C, but he's getting prompts from his interface like, okay, here's what you need to do. Here's the map to the bar, and you got to sneak into the bar's restroom. And when you go into the restroom, the towel holder actually in the virtual world will pull out, and that'll bring the sword down, and then you got to run back out and battle the guy, and he's really hard because you're new and you don't have any health points.
Right.
I just think it's such a cool story.
It's a really cool idea. I think people should check it out. It's easy to find. Go search for searching for Memories, and it'll just come up in Netflix, and watch it. Let us know what you think. I'm gonna keep going. I want to see how this thing turns out. Very intrigued, especially after the last, I don't know, the back half of this thing. This first episode is is where things get really intriguing. And yeah, I'm going to keep going. I was a little worried, to be honest, when he got to the hotel that it was going to be, oh, this is just a dressed up romance novel. Like,
we're like, yeah, romantic comedy. And I think that's one of the things that bugs people later in the series, is that it's not that, and it stays not that. And then at some point in the series, they try to bring a little love interest in, and people are like, no, we didn't want any of that at all. So I'll be curious to see my reaction, knowing that's coming, whether it's really that bad or if it's just the fact that they brought in a love interest story and people were so excited that this didn't follow that trope.
Yeah, it's super cool. And I'm going to keep going. So I'll maybe report back later on other episodes. We'll talk about it and see how we're feeling then. Speaking of autopilots, go ahead.
Secret Worlds.
Dan, oh yeah, that's it. That's it. Secret Worlds is a game. I don't think it's still out there. It went free to play a while ago. Maybe it is. It was really cool at launch, or at least I had some really neat ideas. But it's kind of this. It's like the real world is just a thin layer. There's a thin layer between it and what's possible. And this made me think of that. So if anyone out there hears this and go, "Oh, Secret World, I love that. That was cool," maybe go check it out. Oh, Secret World Legends is still a game. Okay, interesting.
All right.
I feel like I should know that, but I didn't. Next month, Autopilot will be, now we're getting back to some traditional American-grown, fed, corn, whatever all that is. Cheers! We're going to do Cheers!
Now, Cheers is filmed before a live studio audience. it takes place in Boston, so you might need subtitles.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, because they're all speaking Boston.
Yeah. And it's a place where everybody knows your name.
Or if you don't speak English, you'll need subtitles. But this thing is available everywhere. It's on CBS All Access because CBS owns the rights to it. But it's also on Netflix and Hulu because it's one of that CBS back catalog, which this is one of the things that CBS does that I like. They say, look, our originals for CBS All Access, we're going to keep. But the old stuff, we'll put it anywhere. Anybody wants to fork over a couple bucks, Netflix, Hulu, you want it, you got it.
Yeah. What's interesting too is that it was aired on NBC, but it was ABC or CBS Productions.
Yeah.
So that happens a lot and you just forget about it. Like that was part of a, you know.
Yeah. Friends was a Warner production for NBC also, but Warner owns the rights to it.
Yeah. Fox produces certain things for certain other channels. Like that's
CBS produced American Idol for Fox.
Right. Weird.
I don't know if CBS still produces American Idol for ABC. That I don't know.
And I don't even know. Like, if Frasier is the spinoff, I don't know who produced that. Maybe it was CBS. I don't know.
Probably CBS, but I don't know. Yeah,
that's a good question. My wife's in the middle of another binge of that. She loves
Frasier. Oh, really?
Yeah, and that'll be fun because there is no Frasier in that first pilot of Cheers. He came not much later, but about a season later, he would show up.
He's an added character. Yeah.
He was. Just turned out to be a really popular one and went on to have his own very successful sitcom. So anyway, Cheers with Sam and the bar and the people and the whatnot and the norm.
Wicked Kitten 13 has promised to sing the theme song and send it to us. Thank you.
Will you really? We'll play it. Oh my gosh, I'd play it. That'd be great.
Yeah, that'd be great.
Get that over to us. Anyway, that is Cheers, available everywhere. We will be watching the pilot episode of Cheers and talking about it. Excuse me, one Earth month from now. Also, stick around for the end of the show because Legal Geek will be here talking about what's going on with the Supreme Court and having three swing justices now, which is an interesting state of the court.
Swinging justices.
Swinging, baby. They know what's going on Friday night. And then, and a reminder, we're supported by you fine folks at home at patreon.com/currentgeek. Please consider supporting us. We have lots of cool levels, things happening, and stuff shipping. And you can get in also for very little if you want. You can come by and just say, hey, we'll just give you a buck, and that'd be cool. We'll take you. That's over at patreon.com/currentgeek. Tom, before we go, anything else you'd like to say or pimp push?
Yeah, man, I've been having a lot of fun doling out some writing that I've been doing on my writing Patreon, patreon.com/acedetect. But if you want to keep up with that and all of the other things I do, the easiest way is to sign up for my newsletter, freetomnewsletter.com. And in fact, you can just reply to that newsletter if you have something to say to me. It's kind of the easiest way to ask me a question, too. So keep them coming if you're already a subscriber, or become a subscriber at freetomnewsletter.com.
Very nice. Go check that out. For everything else, check out currentgeek.com, and that links out to everything else we do over at frogpants.com. You're bound to find some more stuff you're going to like there. So do check that out. That's currentgeek.com. It's going to do it for us, for me, for Tom, for all of you. We'll see you next time.
Hi, and welcome back to Legal Geek. This week, we finish up our series on the recently concluded Supreme Court term with a look at how there may be more than one swing justice now. When Anthony Kennedy announced his retirement from the court last year, we reflected on his many years serving as the so-called swing justice. While Kennedy was a conservative overall, he would break from his ideological colleagues and join the liberal justices on big issues like abortion and LGBT rights. There was a significant concern that the swing justice role may disappear with Kennedy's departure. But the data is in on Kavanaugh's first term, and it leads to some interesting initial conclusions. Kennedy's replacement, Brett Kavanaugh, did fall solidly in line with the conservatives, voting over 90% of the time in agreement with Chief Justice Roberts and Samuel Alito. However, there were clear distinctions drawn between his views and that of the other Trump nominee to the court, Neil Gorsuch. These two conservative justices voted together only 70% of the time, which is the same amount as Kavanaugh's agreement with liberal justices Elena Kagan and Stephen Breyer this term. There are some significant differences of opinion among the court's conservative members. This has created a scenario in which the four liberal justices, who do vote in line with one another over 85% of the time, have been able to pick off different individuals of the conservative majority, depending on the issue at hand. While Chief Justice Roberts and Brett Kavanaugh are most moderate, and join with the liberals more than the other conservatives, Neil Gorsuch is a bit more of a loose cannon who joins his liberal colleagues on more closely divided issues, including things like criminal defense cases. That means there are three reliable options in Roberts, Kavanaugh, and Gorsuch that the liberal justices can try to convince to join them on any hotly contested issue. That creates a situation which may be more advantageous for the liberals, as they don't always have to deal with the same swing justice. In this regard, there may now be three swing justices on the Roberts court, who each help chart the course for how the most partisan issues are handled over the next few years. If you're curious about the voting statistics and numbers from the first term and want to dive in more, check out the articles and resources available on SCOTUS blog and 538.com. You can find other fun facts like the relative liberal and conservative stance of the most moderate Supreme Court member over the past 40 to 50 terms, as well as which Supreme Court justices disagree with one another the most, that being Clarence Thomas with each of Sonia Sotomayor and Ruth Bader Ginsburg in the 2018-19 term. The bottom line is, there's little doubt that the replacement of Anthony Kennedy with Brett Kavanaugh has ushered in a new era on the Supreme Court. While there's still concern about some long-held precedents being in danger of being overturned in future terms, the data shows that the liberal minority on the court may have a better chance now of gaining a swing vote when needed. As always, we will keep our eyes on the highest court in the land as future terms and significant decisions develop. June and July always lead us to heavy, serious subjects thanks to the annual end to the Supreme Court term, but I'm happy to report we have some interesting geeky subjects to tackle in the next few weeks. See you then. Hey, will you be at Gen Con in Indianapolis next month? If so, The Legal Geek will be there presenting on IP law and game design on Thursday and Friday. Please come check out these educational seminars or track me down on Twitter for a meetup. Thanks for listening. Please provide feedback and segment suggestions to me on Twitter at BuckeyeFitzy.
This show is part of the Frog Pants Network.
Frog Pants Network.
Get more shows like this at frogpants.com.